of Wednesday, so I'm so glad to finally be able to give you that announcement, because I had told you about 2 years ago that I was really interested in this one young lady named Alejandra, and after some time, I finally decided to ask the big question, and she said yes, and so I'm doing pretty good in that regard, and I guess now I'm just trying to assimilate and process everything that that implies. Some may think that it takes me a while to go for it in that sense. And this morning, I want to tell you about another story of an engagement. And I remember that on the previous occasion when I was here, I talked about the story of Ruth. And that was a very remarkable love story as well. In fact, I really think that the story that I'm about to tell you today, as well as the story of Ruth, are really perhaps two of the only neat love stories that you see in the Bible. There's a lot of terrible stories of how relationships worked or did not work in the scriptures, but these two stories are very fascinating and inspiring, and there's a few differences in each. In the story of Ruth, we were seeing how this Gentile woman, a Moabitess, was put in a situation where her husband had died, and so she became an immigrant and went to Bethlehem, and there a man named Boaz was able to take sight of her and to be gentle and intentional in helping her, and little by little things started to unfold so that then they were married, and then they had a child who became like the great-grandfather of David, who was part of that lineage to then eventually bring about our Savior Jesus Christ, who was also born in Bethlehem, that was the place where all this romance was developing. A lot further back in that same lineage of Jesus Christ, we see the story of Isaac and Rebecca. And this story also took place in the midst of a tragedy. Isaac, he had just lost his mother, and within the mourning of having lost his mother, Abraham, his father, was getting pretty old. Remember that Abraham didn't have his son Isaac until he was more than 100 years old. And so he was getting up there. And in fact, Isaac, he was 40 years old, and he still hadn't gotten married. I mean, I'm 35, and a lot of people were pressuring me that I needed to get married if I was ever gonna have kids and, like, I don't know, establish a family. And so you could imagine that same thought for a man that was in his hundreds, and his son still wasn't engaged, and there was no suitable wife candidate for him in the faraway region that he was living. And so he wanted to do something about having his son, Isaac, become betrothed. Today we say engaged, but in the Bible when I'm reading it says betrothed, and that means the same thing as being engaged. And so they devised this really interesting plan for how they might find a potential candidate for Isaac to become married. Now, remember that Isaac was kind of a miracle child. He came about through a promise that God had given to Abraham that through his seed, many nations would be blessed. And it wasn't until many years had passed after God made that promise that Abraham and Sarah eventually gave birth to Isaac. And there was a lot that was hanging on Isaac. You know, if all the nations are going to be blessed through Isaac, and Abraham was well advanced in his years, as well as Sarah, then they really needed to have that son. And they had him, and now 40 years later, he still isn't married. Sarah already died, and Abraham's getting close to dying, and he's like, well, I would really love to see my boy to be with a really special woman. And he didn't want his son to get married to someone out in the foreign country where they were located. And so he wanted the potential bride to come back from the place where he had originally come from. And that's different from the story of Ruth, in that Ruth, she was a foreigner, and rather she was the one that came to Israel, and there she fell in love with Boaz. But basically what took place in this story is that there was a matchmaker, right? Like a Cupid, would that be the term? That there's someone that was in charge of finding the suitable wife for Isaac. And so Abraham tells him, go and find a woman, and if you find her, great. If not, well, I mean, at least you tried. And so he goes out there, and he takes 10 camels with him, and he basically thinks that if I find a woman who is willing to give me water as well as to my camels, then that woman would be the one that would be suitable for Isaac. Like, he thought that this might be a sign for him to be able to determine who of all the women that he may encounter in Israel would be the chosen one to carry on this lineage, this blessing that was going to be imparted to the whole world. And so this matchmaker, he went out, and sure enough, as he approached the area where he was to find the wife, a woman, a very beautiful that had never been with another man, came out to meet him, and he asks her, may I have something to drink? And when we read this story, it's found in Genesis chapter 24, and it's a spectacular story. The details, the way that the author of Genesis is able to bring in so many literary features into this synopsis of what is taking place is really worth your time if you would like to read it. I'm just kind of summarizing the whole story to be able to try to finish on time. And what's interesting when I read this about how the matchmaker for Isaac asks this pretty woman who had never been with another man to give him something to drink, immediately I think of Jesus. And when he was also at a well, and he also asked a woman to give him something to drink. Now, the difference is that on the one hand, this woman in this story, Rebecca, she was a virgin, and she was a very good and righteous woman from what we can perceive. And in the story of Jesus, when he was at the well, it was a Samaritan, someone who was a Gentile, that had a very bad reputation, that is the one that comes into the presence of Jesus. But there again, they both have the same request, give me something to drink. And in any case, as this story unfolds later on, the matchmaker thinks, hey, this could be the one. And he gives her a ring, and that's perhaps the first concept of an engagement ring. Later on, I'm going to show you a few pictures of the engagement that I had with Alejandra just this last Wednesday, and I also gave her a ring. It seems like the ring that Isaac gave, or Isaac's matchmaker gave Rebecca, what she actually put in her nose, which is different. And on top of that, he also, I guess I haven't seen too many people propose to their girlfriend with a ring that they could put on their nose, but that's how it worked back then. And then they go and are able to stay at her father's house, which in fact ends up being a relative of Abraham. And so Abraham turns out being like the great uncle of Rebecca. And so she qualifies for being someone from his own town. And well, probably what's most remarkable about all this story, besides the fact that there were signs as to who this woman would be, and besides the fact that they had to travel so long to interact with this woman, is that after they talked to her and after they told her about Isaac, that they basically needed to take her back all the way to this other land so that she could be married to Isaac, she accepts. That's what's the most amazing thing about this story, is like there's all sorts of features that come into play as the story is evolving. But to think that a woman is interacting with some random guy that comes with some camels and gives him and the camels something to drink, and then all of a sudden they're giving her some gold rings and bracelets, and then they tell her to come back with them, she actually accepts. She's like, okay, I'll do it. I'll go. I'll go to where this man is, and I'll make him my wife. I'm my husband, and he will make me his wife, and we'll be a couple, and we'll live happily ever after. Could you imagine like needing to make a decision like that without knowing absolutely nothing about the person that you're going to get married to? Like, I came here 2 years ago telling you about a young lady that had caught my eye and that I was dating and that I was interested in. And I had already known a lot about her just up until the point I started to date her. And then like 2 years later, I finally asked the question. I finally proposed. But this whole time I was processing, well, like, I do like this about her. Like, maybe this other thing, like, we could work on. And, you know, I mean, it's funny how you're always thinking about the other person when you realize that, in fact, you have quite a bit of problems that I'm sure they need to evaluate whether or not you're really worth it. But I finally made up my mind after knowing so much information about Alejandra. And yet in this story, Rebecca knew absolutely nothing about Isaac, and Isaac knew absolutely nothing about her other than the fact that she was from his same town that his father, Abraham, had come from. And sure enough, they get back on the camels. They head back to where Isaac is located. And it's interesting that in the precise moment when she is coming, Isaac, he just apparently starts to get restless. As you read the whole story, you can see these details. But he just goes out to meditate, is what it says. That, like, for some reason he was in his tent, but then all of a sudden he needed to think. And he goes out, and then he looks, and there are the camels approaching. And it's basically a story of love at first sight, essentially. Here, this woman comes and sees him from afar and immediately puts down her veil. And then they finally meet, and they're married. And then they go back to the tent where Isaac lived and where his mother, Sarah, lived. And in his depression and in his anguish of having lost his mother, then he is comforted by the fact that now he has a beautiful wife. And from there, the whole story of how the lineage of Christ is still in effect. Like, the story didn't die there with the birth of Isaac, but then later on, Isaac, he has two sons, Jacob and Esau, and the story progresses until we come to the story of Ruth, that's in the lineage, and then eventually Jesus Christ. Now, what I want to get at with this whole summary of what I've been telling you about is this concept of engagement, because I'm thinking a lot about that in my own life. And when you're engaged, essentially, you're telling the whole world that I'm set apart for someone else, right? And you have a symbol to demonstrate that. You have a ring that is showing the whole world, hey, I am committed to a relationship with someone else. And if you don't believe me, then just look at my finger. Because right here, I have a ring to prove that another man loves me and that he invested financially in this relationship to show me his love. And I don't want to have another relationship with another man. I want to have a relationship with my betrothed, with my engaged man that I am going to get married to. And the symbol there is significant when we compare it to our own spiritual lives, because we too have been betrothed or engaged to our future husband, who is Jesus Christ himself. And we have committed to that relationship when we believe in Jesus as our Lord and Savior. And he is like our boyfriend that is waiting until the day that we will meet again and we will be married. And there'll be the wedding supper of the Lamb in heaven with a great banquet, and we'll be able to be in the presence of Jesus Christ and enjoy him forever. And we're in this process of anticipation for the day of Christ's return. And when he does return, then we will be with him and we will be married forever, and we will enjoy eternity in the presence of our Lord. But in the meantime, we have this commitment towards Jesus, and we don't want to get distracted with other fleeting pleasures or other temptations that may come along that can somehow ruin our relationship with him. We need to keep our eyes on what's ahead. And I honestly think that if we were trying to compare the wedding ring to something relating to the Christian life, I think that it would be comparable to baptism, right? Because when you get baptized, what you're essentially doing is giving a symbol to the whole world that you are now united with Christ, and you have died to your old nature, and you have been crucified with him and risen again to a new life with Jesus. And so now you're just waiting for the day when he will return, and you will be able to be with him forever. Now, this matchmaker that's in the story of Rebecca, you could imagine that as he is finally with Rebecca, and as they're approaching the place where Isaac is located, how excited on the one hand the matchmaker would be to be able to have said that he fulfilled his job, that he completed the task that he was set out to do, and that he actually found a really good catch, that he found someone spectacular for Isaac. She was a virgin, she was beautiful, and if somewhere along the process, all of a sudden a bunch of other men came along that were trying to woo Rebecca away from the objective, the mission of coming back to Isaac, he would have been extremely frustrated. He would have been really disgruntled. Like, no, you cannot get distracted, because I have a clear objective. I have betrothed you to Isaac. And so please do not look at these other men. Do not even like interact with these other men. Like, I want you fully for my master Isaac. Now, I say that because in the New Testament, there's this concept that Paul, he gives out in the book of 2 Corinthians. And so if we could look to that passage, I'm sorry to have butchered that whole story of Isaac and Rebecca so much. You really have to read it the whole way through it. It'll explain the story a lot better than I just did. But I wanted to get at the fact that in our own lives, we're also betrothed to one husband. And in 2 Corinthians 11, Paul, he has to say a few things to the church in Corinth. So he says the following, verse 1. I wish you would bear with me in a little foolishness. Do bear with me, for I feel a divine jealousy for you, since I betrothed you to one husband, to present you as a pure virgin to Christ. So here Paul, he says that he has betrothed the Corinthian church to one husband, and he senses a godly, divine jealousy for them. See, he, in this story, would compare himself to the servant of Abraham that went out to find a suitable wife for his master Isaac. Paul, in the same way, he went out into the whole world making disciples and preaching Christ crucified and telling the good news of salvation in Christ alone, by faith alone, through grace alone. And some of the people who had accepted this message, who had accepted Christ in their lives, were the Corinthians. And he had a godly jealousy for them. He was like, I need to present you to your husband pure. I need you to be spotless. I need you to be perfect by the time I get back to present you to your husband. And yet, here you are getting distracted. I don't want that. And in verse 3, he says, I'm afraid that as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes and proclaims another Jesus than the one we proclaimed, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or if you accept a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it readily enough. Indeed, I consider that I am not in the least inferior to these super apostles. Even if I am unskilled in speaking, I am not so in knowledge. Indeed, in every way, we have made this plain to you in all things. What Paul is saying here is that he planted the seed in Corinth, and he left that church in the hands of other people, and they continued on. But then this church started having all sorts of problems, and that's why he writes 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, and there would probably be a 3 Corinthians too that is mentioned, but we just don't have record of it. In each one of these letters, he's correcting serious problems that were somehow infecting the church. And the illustration he is making is that I have betrothed you to one husband, and that's to Jesus Christ. And yet, there's all these other false teachers that are coming in the way of what I initially started, and they're really impressive. You know, they are telling you that everything's going to be good. Perhaps they were explaining the health and wealth gospel. Perhaps they were teaching of another Jesus besides the one of Nazareth that was the one that was truly born of God and that died and rose again. Perhaps they were also teaching of a different type of spirit other than the Holy Spirit. And Paul is just like, no, 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 this cannot be. Why in the world are all these super apostles, these really fancy and eloquently speaking teachers coming to you and deceiving you? It's kind of like Satan. They're being like Satan in the way that he deceived Eve and the way that he presented the fruit in such a way that Eve started to think that it was worth it, and she actually accepted it. And Paul, he's just so jealous for the church in Corinth that he says, please do not get distracted from who your true love really is, and that's Jesus Christ. I have betrothed you to him. You have committed to him. You have decided that you want to follow him and him only. In fact, that illustration that I gave you about how the wedding ring could be symbolic of baptism, it's interesting that in Corinthians, Paul, he mentions that he was actually grateful that he didn't baptize very many of the people in Corinth. Now, why is that? Because he had this fear that if he were to baptize the people in Corinth, then they would start to identify themselves with Paul as opposed to identifying themselves with Jesus Christ. And he's like, that would be so counterintuitive to what I'm really trying to do. Like, the whole point is that I'm trying to bring you to Christ. And could you imagine if this matchmaker who was set out to bring Rebecca to Isaac, if all of a sudden Rebecca started falling in love with the matchmaker? Could you imagine how awkward and ironic that would be? It would be like, instead of going back to this husband that I'm engaged to, hey, you're a pretty neat guy. Like, you're the one here with me right now. You're the one that's like talking to me, and I've never been with another man. Like, why don't we have some kind of a fling? Why don't we have some kind of an adventure here? Nobody will know. See, that's what Satan, he does in our own Christian lives. He says, Jesus hasn't come back. We're waiting for him. And look, there's all sorts of other interesting things going on. Yeah, sure, you made a commitment at one point that you're going to follow Jesus. But hey, look at all the other things that I have to offer you. Look at all these other things this world has to offer you. And that's what Satan did to Eve. You know, Eve was in a relationship with Adam. She was in a relationship with God. And that wasn't enough. Satan needed to tell her that she's missing out on something, that there's something more. And that's exactly what sin does in our lives. It tries to distract us from our true love, which is Jesus Christ himself. And so Paul, he sees this. He sees how the church is deteriorating, and it just tears him apart. And he can't do anything more than just send a letter and speak to them to try to remind them of who they really are and of what they have believed in. He says, I may not be as impressive as these other super apostles that are really eloquent, but what I did do was present to you the clear gospel. And that's all that matters. Because you do not believe in me, you believe in Jesus. And I was just the bearer of those good news. I was the herald of the truth of what God had to communicate. And when you believed in him, then this process was initiated of you preparing yourself and keeping yourself pure until the day that Jesus Christ would come back for you. And so this sense of needing to protect this woman who was engaged, essentially the church itself. Later on, he goes on to say in verse 7, or did I commit a sin in humbling myself so that you might be exalted, because I preached God's gospel to you free of charge? I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you. And when I was with you and was in need, I did not burden anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied my need. So I refrained and will refrain from burdening you in any way, as the truth of Christ is in me. This boasting of mine will not be silenced in the regions of Achaia. And why? Because I do not love you? God knows I do. Paul, previously, he says that if anyone is to boast, he should boast only in the Lord, only in what Christ has done. But the situation was so desperate in that these Corinthians were being led astray by all these false teachings that he needed to start to boast a little bit himself. And he continues on to say that he's speaking like a madman and he's crazy for even mentioning some of the good things that he's done and some of the important aspects of his ministry. But he's doing it to kind of defend the fact that he's legit. He's the one that has truly given the message of the gospel that the Corinthians have originally believed, and they need to go back to that same message. They need to go back to that same principle, the essence of what was originally taught, and not get distracted by all these other things. And so he's saying that part of his ministry was fascinating, and it was that he went and he preached the gospel free of charge so that the people who were listening to the gospel in no way would consider that there was like an association with his intention of teaching them about Jesus to then become wealthy himself. He was so concerned about the purity of the message that he didn't want money to get tampered into the picture by somehow then collecting an offering, even though it would have been completely legitimate for Paul in his ministry to request that those he was teaching somehow support his life. What he did, in fact, was to rob other churches. And that's really strong language. What is he saying? He's saying that there were other churches in the regions of Achaia and elsewhere that supported his life and ministry so that when he went to Corinth, he could preach and the Corinthians would have to give him nothing in return. Because the gospel is free. It's the most costly thing ever, but it's free. And even though offerings and money are an important aspect of church life and of our own demonstration of our commitment, perhaps, to the work of Christ, in those initial stages, sometimes people can be really leery of someone coming to teach them something from the Bible, thinking that there's an indirect relationship here with them later trying to extort them or manipulate them. And it's so sad for me to see in Colombia, even, that many times, although I meet people who are eager to know about Jesus, they're reluctant to go to a church because they think that somehow they're going to get robbed. And they have valid reason to believe that because it's happened to them on many occasions. But Paul, he was so careful in the way he presented the gospel. He knew the gospel backwards and forwards, and he was going to present it in the most pure way possible. And so what's weird, and I've seen this in my own life, is that sometimes when you present something for free, people think it isn't that valuable. But if they have to pay for it, all of a sudden they'll treasure it and they'll cherish it. And that was the problem that Paul was running into. He was giving them the gospel free of charge. And so since it was free, they didn't really care too much about its importance. They were like, well, I never had to work for this. I never had to contribute in any way. But these other super apostles are coming and I'm giving them their money and I'm giving them my money. And so I have a vested interest. I've somehow put my stock into what's taking place over here. And I got this other thing for free. And so Paul, he's like, I did this because I love you. And even though you feel like you don't love me just because you received this without having to work for it, I love you so much. And the whole reason why I came in the first place was to present you as a pure bride to Christ, to one husband, to Jesus Christ. And please do not get distracted from that. I thank you. I thank you, Wauwatosa Bible Chapel. And I thank you so many other churches and friends in the States that have contributed towards my life and ministry so that when I'm in Cúcuta or Bogota and I'm sharing the gospel, that isn't the first thing that I'm worried about, is how am I going to survive? And are these people that I'm sharing the gospel to going to be able to give me some money so that I can keep doing it? That's not even on my radar. And I can guarantee you that the people that I'm trying to work with, there is no way that they could try to repay me for presenting the gospel to them, because they're as broke as a joke. And they're coming from a country that their economy has collapsed completely. And to think that in starting a church, I would need all these people that are completely destitute to not only pay for the rent of the building where we live, but also to pay for my own livelihood, is completely impractical. There was no way that I would ever reach out to these people if that's the system that needed to be in play. I would only reach out to really wealthy people because they could actually support me. And what would be in it for me, you know? But this way, I can approach any person, rich or poor, Venezuelan or Colombian, and just present the essence of the gospel without needing to even impress them, because it's not the person who presents the gospel. It's not even the ability of the person who presents the gospel to convince those people that they need to accept it. It's the gospel itself. The gospel is what saves. It's Jesus Christ who saves. And that's what Paul was doing. And he had that privilege because he was robbing other churches. In a sense, I'm robbing churches here in the States by receiving your gifts so that then I can go speak and live and share with others in a way that they do not have to repay me or they would ever need to, because the gospel itself is free, and so I want to present it as well in a free way. Now, in verse 12, it says, "And what I am doing, I will continue to do in order to undermine the claim of those who would like to claim that in their boasted mission, they work on the same terms as we do. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So it is no surprise if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. Their end will correspond to their deeds. I repeat, let no one think of me foolish, but even if you do, accept me as a fool, so that I too may boast a little. What I am saying with this boastful confidence, I say not as the Lord would, but as a fool. Since many boast according to the flesh, I too will boast, for you gladly bear with fools, being wise yourselves. For you bear it if someone makes slaves of you, or devours you, or takes advantage of you, or puts on airs, or strikes you in the face. To my shame, I must say, we were too weak for that." There's a lot of sarcasm going on here, but they're really serious issues that Paul is talking about. He's essentially describing tyrants. Within these churches, there were people who were coming in who were false teachers, who were extremely eloquent, but they were abusing the flock. And Paul, he's realizing this, that these are the sheep that he's trying to present to the Lord. This is the bride of Christ. What would be the worst thing that you could do to my girlfriend? It would be to abuse her, to cheat her, to speak poorly about her to the rest of the world. It would be to also try to get her to fall in love with someone else. I would be so mad at you if you tried to do that with my girlfriend, with my fiance, you know? And Paul, he was realizing that these false teachers, they were tampering with the bride of Christ. And that bothered him tremendously. And he calls these men out and he's like, "I'm too weak to come in and abuse you like these other people. I'm too gentle. I'm too nice. I'm not even charging you for my ministry. And it's all because I love you. It isn't because I'm weak. It's just because that's the way that I've chosen to do it, because that's the correct way. And these other people who are more impressive and who have somehow lured you into their trap, they're just deviating you from the essence of what it is to really be a Christian. So he says, "But whatever anyone else dares to boast of, I'm speaking as a fool, I also dare to boast of that." And then he goes on to say some about his pedigree, about where he came from, and he also talks about all the different dangers and the difficulties that he's faced in his ministry. And I really think that in many ways, when you're willing to sacrifice so much for someone, that is the ultimate demonstration of your love for them, right? If with my fiance, I'm willing to invest my time, invest my emotions, invest my resources in being with her and making sure she's okay, and in the process having to get beat up myself or having to spend sleepless nights just listening to her process some of the difficulties that she's going through, or needing to use what little money I have to go and visit her or things like that, that would demonstrate that I really love her, right? And Paul, he's using these examples of how he was shipwrecked and how he was beaten and how he was imprisoned. Like all these things, those are the evidences of his true apostleship, of his true ministry as a herald, as a disciple of Christ, is that I've suffered for it. And these scars of mine, they're here to prove that I'm here to serve Christ. And he even goes on to say that these scars are in some way or another, like complementing the scars that Jesus himself has, or they're like filling up the void of the punishment or the suffering that Christ endured. Like there's still more suffering out there, and I'm going to suffer it because Christ first suffered for me, and I'm going to continue to suffer for his church. All these things, when you're reading Paul, just sort of surprise you in the way he's interacting, and he's dealing with these Corinthians in a very sarcastic way, but to try to get at their heart, to remind them of what the true message was really all about. In any case, then in verse 14 he says, "Here for the third time I am ready to come to you, and I will not be a burden, for I seek not what is yours, but you. For children are not obligated to save up for their parents, but parents for their children." I love that about Paul. Like, he wasn't interested in the Corinthians' wealth. He wasn't interested in what they could give him in return. What's in it for me? He was only interested in saving up for them. He was the one that was there that was wanting to give to them. And in the same way for me, when I'm down in Colombia and I'm working with Venezuelans, like I don't look at them, or sometimes I realize that I can have bad intentions, or I could have a bad attitude, and I confess that, and I need to do better. But when I see my friends, I don't want to have them need to give me something in return. Like I want to be generous with my own life and my own time and my own resources, and be able to show them that that I love them. And even if they take advantage of that, or they abuse of it, or in some cases they don't respond as I wish they would respond, that doesn't mean that I love them less, but I just keep loving them. And within my own mistakes of learning how to help and not help, and how to be tactful and how to be sensitive, like I know that there's a lot of things that I need to learn and I need to improve in my own ministry, but the fact that I'm there and I'm doing it is a miracle in and of itself. And I thank you so much for being a part of it and for being able to fellowship with me in that sense. He says that I am not interested in what you have, but I'm interested in you. You know, that's Jesus's love for us as well. What do we have to give back to him? There is nothing that we have that he doesn't already own. So does Jesus love us because there's something that he's going to get out of it in return? No, he just loves us because he wants us. And for us to think that there's some kind of alternative plan that is going to later give us a really miserable life is ridiculous. To think that there's some kind of scheme that can't really be true, all that we hear about in the gospel, that God really can't love us that much. Well, he does, and he loves us beyond what you can imagine. His love is inexplicable. It's indescribable. It's amazing, and he gave it all because he wants us, and he wants his glory to increment and to be in a relationship with us. It's beautiful to think of how special he's been for each one of us. I guess with that, I would just like to show you a few pictures of my girlfriend, my fiance now, Alejandra, and also be able to show you a few pictures of the ministry down in Colombia. And so I have a slideshow that I'd like to present, and I'll go through real quickly here. Okay. I basically took Alejandra out to this town called San Vicente del Caguán, and I had never been there before. I wanted to go to someplace exotic, and this place had been known for a lot of violence and a lot of guerrilla activity in the past. And so I took a flight, and we arrived in this small little Piper three-passenger plane, and she didn't even know where we were. But then I took her to this bridge, and I proposed to her right there. And in the same way, like just like this town has had a bad reputation, like I want to redeem that. I want people to now know of this town as being the town where Sam proposed to his girlfriend. Like, you don't know anything about this town other than the fact that in San Vicente del Caguán, Sam proposed to his girlfriend. The rest of the world, when they hear this town, they're going to think of all sorts of guerrilla activity that happened there in the early 2000s. But I'm changing that. We're changing that. And that's what God has done to our own lives. And in many ways, Alejandra, too, she came from a rough past. And I don't want people to remember her rough past. I want people to know her like positive present, you know, her positive reality right now. And so I got down on the knee, and then she said yes and put on the ring. We actually didn't even know that you're supposed to put it on the left hand, so we did it on the right hand, but then like we Googled it and we realized that you're supposed to put it on the left hand. And then I took her out to this breathtaking canyon there where the river ran through, and this was the plane that I took her on. And just some pictures there. These are my two wingmen that helped me out in the whole ordeal and the process of like making sure she didn't know, and helping me to find a tour guide. The one fellow in the light blue shirt, his name is Esteban, and he works in tourism. And Franklin, he works there in the airport, like filling the planes with gasoline. And both of these guys were some of my first disciples that I had as a missionary when I went to the jungles of Colombia for my first missionary experience. And I started playing soccer with these guys. And even though they're not necessarily doing really great in their relationship with Christ, they've both, you know, carried on. And especially Franklin, the one in the darker blue, He married a Christian wife, and he goes to church occasionally. But what's interesting about both of them is that they had sons, and each one of them named their son Samuel. And they named him, I guess, because of the friendship that we had, and that I left a mark on them. But as I consider that, it's like, do I really care that I have a couple namesakes from a couple of my close friends from San Jose? I don't really, to be honest. What I really care about is that they would have a close relationship with Jesus, because it's not about me, and it's not about what I shared with them, and it's not about what I told them. If I only was able to befriend them in such a way that I left a mark on their lives, then I missed the whole point. The purpose is that I befriend them and share with them and teach them so that Jesus would have left a mark on them. And I still am glad that they were a part of this eventful day in my life, and I keep thinking that whenever I go back there, it'll be so great to meet up with all these people and like spend 3 months where we can just kind of grow together in the Lord, and hopefully one day that'll happen. This was after the engagement. The next day I went out with Alejandra and her parents and her twin sister and my two parents, and we went and had a special meal there in Bogota. So these are some pictures of the Venezuelan ministry. I had shown a few of you guys these pictures previously, and this is how it all started in the hotel of Bogota, where a lot of Venezuelan immigrants stayed. This is what the people have to cross there in Cucuta as they're crossing the border from Venezuela into Colombia. And with my friend Paul, we were able to go out there. And this was one time where I was trying to get into Colombia after being in Venezuela, and I was exhausted, and yet all these other people had far less advantages than I did, and yet they were also trying to get into Colombia. This was when I was with Paul in Cucuta, and we went right there to the border, and we had done a missions trip, and I thank you so much for him and for his support and for how he was able to bring along these other young students to help in this process of making disciples for Christ. These are some of the other people. Remember that I had told you that this woman in the yellow shirt, her name was Ruth, and that's why I told you the story of Ruth the last time that I had been here in Milwaukee. And this was how the church originally started, especially with a lot of street musicians I've connected with and gotten to integrate them into the church, which is phenomenal because now our church has a really good worship team. This was how then we started doing Bible studies in my small little apartment. And the majority of the people in this picture, Paul would even know because he was there sharing with them, and they're military dissidents, people that had fled the military in Venezuela to seek asylum and refuge in Colombia. And unfortunately, they haven't been given all the things that they were promised, and they're kind of in limbo. They don't know what's going to happen. Some of them have returned. Some of them have gone to other countries. That's always been the biggest challenge, is that people are so transient within this ministry, but they're very open and very willing to accept the gospel. This is out there just doing some street evangelism and bringing some of my Venezuelan friends with me. There's Alejandra. She has been a part of the group. And this young girl with the Barcelona shirt on, her and her parents, they moved to Bogota, and they were in my apartment for some time, and then they have gotten really involved in our church in Bogota, and they're consistently there, participated in the different ministries, and there's a few other friends that have also stayed involved with the church, even though they've gone on to other locations. This is just what some of the meetings look like. And more recently, we've started a lunch where I meet with some of the street vendors and street musicians every Saturday. And we do a Bible study, and then I talk to them about different principles of work that we see in the Bible. And if they have different projects that they're wanting to start, then maybe I can invest a little bit in that and give them ideas to how to organize it some more. And so these are all the different street vendors and musicians that I meet with on Saturdays, and this is what our Sunday morning meeting looks like. And now we're a little bit more established. We have a little bit more traction as there's been more people that have gotten involved that have a little bit more stability. So that's exciting and it's encouraging. This Sunday, I have a friend from Bogota that's preaching there, and then the following two Sundays, the parents of that young woman there who's playing the keyboard, she's Venezuelan, and her parents are Christian pastors in Venezuela. And I met her in a really interesting way through social media, where a person that I had never met was talking to a person that he had never met that was taking Spanish classes online from this girl that he had never met, who lived in Cucuta but was a Christian that was from Venezuela. And so I went and I met her for the first time, even though the three other people that were involved in the process for me to meet her weren't involved. I finally got to befriend her, and she also started helping us out with the ministry, which has been phenomenal. We even have a violin player in our worship service, so it's really cool. And I'm just so excited that I can serve in this way, and thank you for your prayers, thank you for your support, and especially thank you to you, Paul, too, because it means a lot that you're here today, and I thank you for how you've been so sensitive to this huge tragedy, essentially, this calamity that's taking place in Colombia and in Venezuela and all of South America as the situation is unraveling itself right before our eyes, and we're seeing that. that so many immigrants are desperate. And within that desperation, I want to point them to Christ, and I want to do it like Paul. And even though I'm not that impressive, the main thing I want to get right is the gospel. You know, I just have to go back to the gospel. And if I'm going to do anything, I got to preach the word. I can't preach any weird philosophies. I can't be out there to manipulate them or to think about what's in it for me. You know, I just want to present them as a pure and spotless bride to Christ. I want to be that matchmaker. I want to be that Cupid that will be able to be in heaven one day and be able to present before Jesus, his bride, and say, look, I was able to help in some way or another so that these people here are here before you and are worshiping you today, along with me. I'm not better than anyone else. I'm also Jesus's bride, and it's such a joy to be engaged to Alejandra, but even more than that, to be engaged to Jesus Christ. And I look forward to that wedding day when we'll all be in his presence. Thank you very much. Yeah. Dear Lord, I thank you for this church, and I pray that we too can stay focused on our love towards you. I pray, Lord, that we won't be deceived by weird teachings and other distractions that Satan may throw at us. And I thank you for solid men and women who have gone before us that have explained the gospel in such a way that we have understood it, and in such a way that was honest, and in such a way that glorified you and pointed to Jesus Christ. It's all about him. And I pray that we too might be jealous for your church, and that we would be sure to keep our disciples focused on what really matters. And I pray that you would help my friends in Venezuela or in Colombia, and with so many of them just going from country to country or city to city, and so many of them who are hearing so many weird things as they're traveling, and there's so many other interesting options out there and different doctrines and different religions. I pray, Lord, that that seed that was sown would stay with them, and they wouldn't deviate from the right or to the left, but they can continue to grow as your disciples, and that they can love you and be mature and find stability, and that you would receive all the glory and honor forever and ever. Amen.